Blog Talk Radio.
United is on the air. How's everyone out there doing tonight? Thanks for joining us in the chat room and here on the internet radio site. My name is Jamie, and Chris and Jerry both are here with us tonight. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up? Word.
It's good to have you both with us tonight, guys.
It's good to be here.
Has it been an exciting weekend for you? I know, Jerry, you've probably seen a dozen movies already this
weekend. That's not always true. We'll talk about that in a moment, but go to Chris, because Chris hasn't been on that much, and everyone wants to hear from him, so I do.
Oh, okay.
You flatter me, Jerry. Too sweet. Actually, I saw one of my favorite movies of last year this weekend, and I saw one of what probably, if I would have seen it, probably would have made my worst of 2007 list.
Oh, this I got to hear.
One of the best, first off, The Savages.
Yes.
Incredible movie.
Just, wow.
It is.
It just happens to play upon a personal fear of my own.
Mm-hmm.
I'll end up taking, care of my parents, and it just really touches on that issue so sensitively and so emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
That I really had a tremendous experience watching it.
It is that way, yes.
And the worst was Frank Darabont's The Mist.
You didn't like it?
Oh, my God. I thought it was embarrassingly bad. Laugh out loud horrible, actually.
Really?
Really? Okay. Yeah. But, all right, what was it about the film that you didn't... What was the first thing while you were watching that gave you that feeling?
The number one thing that gave me that feeling, the first time in the movie that I went, was Thomas Jane. Who I've always thought was okay before. I never really thought one way or the other about him.
Right.
But he is way out of his league in terms of what's expected of a leading man and what he, as an actor, I guess, was able to bring to this project. He's not the caliber actor that can fit into that role of the guy who needs to be in every shot of every scene. And there's some weird choices with his acting here that I was not crazy about.
Okay.
But that was just the beginning. That literally was the first thing that came to my mind. There was so much more to it that bothered me.
But that
I'm sure,
first
I'm
thing
sure that's
just...
I'm sure that surprised you, though, because you having said, Stephen King seems to be really in good hands with Darabont, and we've all said that in the past.
Yeah.
We've had no
I'm
reason
surprised,
not to.
Surprised, but not surprised.
No, but I'm talking about Chris.
It
must have surprised you that you didn't react as well to it as you thought you would.
It really did, because my girlfriend had seen it and told me how awful it was, and we don't always agree on movies, so I wanted to make my own decision. I rented it, and I was surprised, even though I probably shouldn't be surprised. There's far more poor versions of Stephen King novels than there are good ones. Unfortunately, this fits snugly into the former category.
Really? I thought this was one of the better ones, but, I understand. It seems like the Thomas Jane is just the beginning of this downward spiral for you.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Like I said, there was much more to it than that. The characters in it made such silly decisions, all of them, from the very beginning. None of their decisions seemed motivated by anything other than, just to move the story into bizarre directions. The logic of the whole thing with the mist is pretty fuzzy, and like I said, the decisions the characters make when things I was wanting bad things to happen to them because they were so
God, you must have loved the ending then.
Actually, I was happy with the ending, although Although it was one bullet shy of a perfect ending, in my opinion.
Kind of thing that they should put on, like, you know, the quotes.
Without giving away the ending, because the ending is what everyone finds most discussion worthy about The Mist. I like the ending, just not the very last shot. I think they should have gone all the way with the ending. Except putting in what is the equivalent of like a really vicious punchline at the very last shot. I thought it would have been more harrowing had they gone all the way with it.
Yeah, it did seem, that part does seem unnecessary, whereas the previous part, other than the last shot, I don't really see what everyone is talking about. I think that that's an appropriate ending for, you know, while I don't like the movie, I don't think that the ending's inappropriate.
Oh, I don't think it's inappropriate.
Because
it's billed
as an apocalyptic film anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I have no problem with the film, and I just find it, I like Chris, because Chris sort of brings us back down to earth in many ways, and it's just, I just like to hear your rationale when you like or don't like something, because it's very original.
Like I said, I really wanted to like this movie. I love Frank Darabont. I mean, I should say that. And I also, even though I didn't like the movie, I went and watched all the special features with him and even some of the commentary because I like him that much.
Right.
I'd love to hear what he says about a movie I didn't like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully the next one will be better for him, because the last two, I can't.
I kind of like the idea that he was intentionally, after Shawshank and Green Mile, which are higher caliber Stephen King works. I mean, they're kind of the upper echelon in terms of character and themes and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He delighted in the idea of making a Stephen King monster movie.
Yeah.
Almost like a B movie.
Yeah, very much a B movie. And in fact, the that special edition DVD has the black and white version, which I heard that's actually a really interesting way to watch it. And as I was watching the movie, I was thinking about that, and I could see how it would work very well, because it does seem like it could have been made in the 50s or something like that.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, it has a Twilight Zone, an episode of the Twilight Zone quality, old Twilight Zone, Outer Limits kind of feel to it.
Exactly. And if it was that 30-minute runtime, it probably would have been one of the better Twilight Zone episodes ever seen.
Yeah, probably.
But it is, I just didn't feel like there was enough there to stretch it into 2 hours, even for a great filmmaker like Frank Darabont.
Right. Well, all right. You can't please everyone. I understand that.
But the whole subplot of, you knew that it was inevitable. The whole subplot of, you know, this is God, this is apocalypse, and the whole Marcia Gay Harden subplot. It was. Did you find it far-fetched? I didn't necessarily find that far-fetched, though.
Didn't find it far-fetched at all.
I can't agree with that. No. I mean, it goes a little far. I can see how maybe people would really...
Are you sharpening steak knives while you're talking?
I can see how people would interpret a situation like that as, you know, the apocalypse and a sign of the... But the idea that all of a sudden people who are Christian will suddenly jump and start killing people and demanding blood and things like that, that's a little bit extreme and not representative.
History hasn't taught us that.
Only Huckabee, you know.
But we're talking about a single situation in a single history hasn't taught us that at all. I mean, yeah, there are wars in which people were killed for Christianity, but I think it does, and I don't even call myself a Christian, but I don't think that it really paints an accurate portrait of the Christian, of, you know, Christian belief.
I was talking to Aaron about it, actually, and Aaron said it kind of belittles that viewpoint all the way through it.
I think it does very much, actually.
And then it turns out to be the correct viewpoint.
Well, that's interesting, yeah. That's actually very true. Then again, you got to think that ending was tacked on. That was not part of the original script. They wanted to make this movie for quite a while and couldn't figure out a way to end it. Frank Darabont or Stephen King.
Yeah.
They just kind of, you know, whipped that up at the very end. But like you said, actually, it is an appropriate ending. But nevertheless,
it's a shocking ending in the sense for a mainstream Hollywood movie at Thanksgiving. that's a shocking ending. That's not something. That's not.
Yeah, it was not released at the right time.
What is it with the Weinsteins? Hey, we're going to release Grindhouse Easter weekend. Let's release The Mist on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I know. It's like their decision to release Bad Santa around Christmas time. It made perfect sense, but remember, people were up in arms about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that makes perfect sense out of all of them. Actually, I'm secretly hoping Bad Santa becomes the Christmas go-to movie in the future, you know, outside of Christmas Story or...
Well, Christmas Story and Christmas Vacation, I'd love to see Bad Santa. Hey, we should try to get those guys on for Christmas time.
Oh, that's a hysterical movie.
Yeah.
So, I like Toby Jones. I was glad to see Toby Jones in a movie. After Infamous, because Jerry and I talked about this, the comparison between Capote and Infamous.
Mm-hmm.
And Toby Jones played Capote. He had the misfortune of making a parallel Capote movie at the same time Philip Seymour Hoffman
was.
So his version kind of took the back seat, and I always found his version so much superior, so much more alive.
It's meatier.
Yeah.
I didn't get to see that because the Philip Seymour Hoffman version, not his performance, but the movie left such a bad taste in my mouth. But
it's very droll.
Yes,
you know?
It is.
Yeah, somber. And Truman Capote, I mean, he kind of this research they did for this book kind of changed him, but actually he was a extremely lively, a raconteur,
yeah.
A gossip, you know, somebody that reveled in their position, and you didn't get that as much in Hoffman's version.
No,
I
get that. It's really Infamous. I do think I do think his performance in Capote is good, and I also think. Help me out. Her name is Escape. Catherine Kinner's performance is great in that movie. But as a movie itself, I just think Infamous is so much better. I really do. As just a movie,
I think
the characters are much more interesting, the situation.
And you're right about the Harper Lee part. And Infamous is played by Sandra Bullock, who's fine.
Yeah.
But Catherine Kinner, she doesn't have to say anything. Her presence is just much
mm-hmm.
more powerful than Sandra Bullock, you know.
Yeah, I like Toby Jones was good in that. Yeah.
What's that, man?
Toby Jones was good in The Mist, but he's also one of the few bright spots in that one, The Painted Veil, which was I guess came out just a couple months after Infamous. He's an interesting. I hope, like you said, I hope we get to see more of him because he's a very interesting actor.
Yeah. Cannes Film Festival's coming up, guys. And man, it just seems like time has flown. I mean, we're
talking about that. It seems like
we're reaching. You know, now that we're after the 1 year point of our show, it seems like just yesterday when we were just touching upon this stuff last year. But the competitors have been announced, and there are a couple of American filmmakers in competition. A couple of really interesting films too. Clint Eastwood's new film, Changeling,
mm-hmm.
with Angelina Jolie, will be in competition. And so, you know, Eastwood, as I like to call him, Squint Eastwood, he is very, I mean, he doesn't let up. I mean, he doesn't slow down at all.
No, I'm a big admirer of Eastwood, so I think it's just great. I mean, I hope I am active like that
yeah.
at his age.
Yeah, and for this latest movie to be entered into the Cannes competition, I mean, that goes to show you that at least he thinks, or the people behind his film thinks, that it's just as vital as anything work he's ever done.
Right.
You know.
Now, is this a remake of the movie The Changeling?
No.
Is this something completely different?
I think it's different.
Okay, that's cool. No, that's good.
It is in different territory, because I think it might have thriller aspects to it,
mm-hmm.
from what I've read about it. But it's mostly a drama, like a 1950s drama, I think.
Okay.
Steven Soderbergh's new movie, which is a four-hour movie,
it's 4 hours?
It's two different films.
But there's Che, and then there's the Argentinian, right? Or the Argentine, or...?
Yeah, the Argentine, yeah. And Guerrilla. Those are the two titles of the movies that encompass the whole four-hour experience.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's strange because they put them together because two separate movies wouldn't be commercially viable or whatever, but the irony of that is that one four-hour movie doesn't seem like it's commercially viable.
It's not commercial. It's just not...
this is one of those projects that just...
a labor of love.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it because I love everybody that's involved in it,
mm-hmm,
especially
yeah.
in Soderbergh, but you can't really hold out much hope that this will be one of those prestigious pictures like The Departed or Million Dollar Baby that makes a lot of money, too. Can that...
Right.
Can it, I mean, can you see that happening, really?
I think among the college students, I see it being a big film.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know after that. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's like college students. That's like a $5 million gross, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. That's a very kind gross because
yeah.
they're not going to go watch it on BitTorrent.
When you're trying to buy a keg of Natty Light, there's not much leftover money for
a four-hour movie.
New four-hour Soderbergh movie about Che, you know.
Yeah. Wim Wenders is returning to the festival as well. He has a new film.
What's his new film?
It's called The Palermo Shooting.
Okay, I have a film from Netflix by him called Land of Plenty that I haven't gotten around to watching yet.
Yeah.
I think it came out, it was either before or after the one with Sam Shepard, Don't Come Knocking. But that it never got a theatrical release around here. But I like him a lot, so I'd be curious to see how that goes.
Actually, one of our friends who has his own radio show, he was doing the Countdown of Soundtracks. And I was so, Jason O'Brien, and I was so... happy because he included a Wim Wenders soundtrack from that movie Until the End of the World.
I love
that
movie.
Not many people know about, but it's an amazing just as a soundtrack. It's incredible.
I took a German film course
mm-hmm.
when I was in college, and we learned we watched his films Fassbinder and Herzog and. But Wenders was early on from the just loved American rock and roll.
Right.
I mean, he worships it, and
right.
So his soundtracks have always been good.
Yeah, this one's all over the place. This one's this soundtrack was U2,
he loved
U2. REM, Lou Reed,
mm-hmm.
Katie Lang was in it. I mean, it's all over the place. And then Charlie Kaufman, he's behind the camera now for the first time, directing his first movie, and that's in competition as well. And I can't pronounce the city in New York that this is from. Sinekdoche, New York? I don't know how that city is pronounced.
Neither do I. Great. All right. But I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Philip Seymour Hoffman's in it. They say it's another mind-bender from Kaufman. And then outside of competition, the big thing that everybody will be talking about is the screening of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, that it chose Cannes as its worldwide forum. You know.
Wow.
Yeah. This is a worldwide movie, and so it is the biggest platform to kind of announce. You know, we're coming. We're going to be out in a matter of days.
That's true.
Yeah. And Woody Allen's new movie with Penelope Cruz and Scarlett Johansson. I know that Chris is already salivating over there.
True. I salivate over any Woody Allen movie, let alone one that has Scarlett
Those
Johansson.
Those two actresses in them, yeah.
Penelope Cruz. And Javier Bardem. You know, I can't deny that if I had to... if I had to bed a big hunking Spaniard, then it'd probably be my choice.
There you go. There you go, folks. You heard it here first.
And apparently Penelope Cruz and Scarlett Johansson lip lock in this movie too, Chris. So that's
I'll be there opening day.
Woody Allen has downplayed the sexual nature of the film.
It's the film after this one though that we're all looking forward to as well. With Larry David.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's how the Cannes Film Festival is shaping up. Tribeca started this weekend, and we're going to get reports from that festival from Keith Ulick in the next week and a half, 2 weeks, when he returns from it.
Now, Baby Mama opened up that festival, right?
Yeah.
And then I think Speed Racer is closing it?
Closing it, yeah.
I have not heard anything about Speed Racer yet, good
or bad. And those are the two high-profile... the opening and closing movies, the two Hollywood kind of things that are starting up a festival, but that everybody's talking about. But Tribeca's been getting a bad rap lately, the past couple of years, because it seems inundated with all this kind of higher profile Hollywood fair.
Yeah.
So this year they've really gone out of their way. I think they have they're inundated with movies from across the globe.
Well, they should. It's an important. It was a great idea. So
yeah.
What was the remember one year? I think it was 2002. Attack of the Clones was the opening.
Yeah.
Opening film and. You know, the A.O. Scott review that day, oh, God, that was harsh. I don't care who you are. That must have hurt. George Lucas must have been in pain reading that one.
And then Iron Man, we don't have to wait as long as we originally thought to see Iron Man. It opens, isn't it like an opening Friday, May 2nd? But screenings will start 8 p.m. the previous night on Thursday.
Oh, yeah, I know. That should be fun. That'd be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to that. I just think it's, you know, a lot of people, like, in the press and everything a couple of years ago, like, wrote Robert Downey Jr. off. You know, they said, you know, because of all the tabloid stuff and everything. I just think he must be having, like, the last laugh right now.
Well, according to advanced reviews, he is, because the critics that have seen it, because it's screened for critics, most of them already, say that Robert Downey Jr. is a major movie star, that he is irresistible in this movie.
And that's something we, like, I think the three of us can say we've known for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the films didn't make money, or they weren't big, but we've known this for, I guess, since high school, really. You know,
right.
He's always been good, whether it was, like, Chaplin or Lesson Zero, or he's versatile, he's good, and you just watch Zodiac.
Yeah.
And Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah.
I mean, he's incredible.
Such charisma, man. Especially in, like, in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, such charisma.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a movie star performance right there.
Yeah.
And then the depth that he brings to Zodiac with, you know, where he's sharing the screen with four other characters that dominate the running time.
Right.
He's incredible.
He is. He really is. I am so happy that he's getting these parts, and he's, like, just doing... And I think Tropic Thunder, I think he's going to astound everyone with that.
Yeah, yeah. This is his summer, I think.
Which is
great, because he's a fantastic actor, and he's not somebody that you equate with a big uber blockbuster. But it's been whispered about since the beginning of his career. You know, when is he going to break with his big blockbuster, you know?
This is it.
And he's got it, which is great. And talk about a dynamite cast for this kind of movie.
Well, I think that's what. So when I read the cast, you know, when they first announced it, it was like, you know, Downey and then Paltrow and Terrence Howard, Jeff Bridges. I mean, you don't get much better than this. This is an awesome lineup.
Yeah, and that level of acting talent just ups the game
mm-hmm.
for this genre picture. Now these people are serious about making this as legitimate as they can.
Yes.
Whereas you're hearing more and more bad reports about the Norton's Hulk, which also has a good cast. I mean, he and William Hurt, and it's the same old story. And I want to talk about these two stories because we talked about Uwe Boll and him being kind of banned from making movies.
World of Warcraft he was banned from.
Yeah, but then we talk about, we can examine like two incredibly talented people, Edward Norton and David O. Russell, and the problems that they bring to every project they undertake, whether it's
And he brings a lot of problems, Ed Norton.
Because his hands are in the pie, you know, but... and they should be. I mean, I think they should be because obviously he has good sense about story and the direction
of taking. I think he has very good sense. I'm just surprised. I'll be very honest with you. I'm surprised that he did this movie. I won't lie to you. I'm still, you know, he hated doing the remake of The Italian Job. He had to do that for Paramount, but he really let it be known that he wanted nothing to do with that movie. I was just surprised to see him attached to the Hulk.
I think it's a great Marvel character, though.
It's
got depth that a great actor would love to sink his teeth into.
I agree with you. It just seems like it just doesn't seem like something he would like to do, though.
But it's not surprising now that we're hearing reports that you know he's trying to undercut the Marvel's wishes for the final cut of the movie, and and put more depth and less action in there. Apparently, it ends with like a 35 minute action scene. Like the battle is the last third of the movie, which is insane.
He's an interesting actor, and I think the 25th Hour, Fight Club, Primal Fear. I even like the little bit he has in Frida. He's an incredible actor, and
I think his participation in Incredible Hulk can only make for a more unique experience.
It's going to be interesting to compare this one with the Ang Lee, Eric Bana one.
What are your thoughts, Chris?
I've got a lot of thoughts about it. First of all, I really want to see it because I love the Hulk and comic book in general. But it's strange that it does make sense to me that he would do this movie. At first, I thought it was weird, but really, if you look at his resume, although he's got a lot of really great films, like he's made really wise choices as an actor, he hasn't had the most successful in terms of box office. Like,
right,
not
that's
really,
true.
He's not really proven as a bankable star, although, like I said, I love most of his movies. Really good choices.
Yes.
That said, it seems like, and I just read an interview with Louis Leterrier, where he was kind of siding with Edward Norton, actually. The initial reports were, I think, a little bit confused. The problem is not between Leterrier and Edward Norton. The problem is a difference of opinion between the two of them, the director and the star, and Marvel Comics.
That's right.
Right. Marvel Comics wants the stripped-down, shorter, action-packed, explosive version of the movie, and Leterrier and Norton want a little bit more character development, a little bit more depth to the character, and a little bit longer, more dramatic piece, which, ironically, is what made the first one not work so well for people. So I can see where Marvel would say, hey, whoa, hold on, like, that's exactly what we don't want.
Right.
You know?
Well, and this is a do or die summer, and I think both movies are gonna gross well enough, especially Iron Man. I think Iron Man will be a blockbuster. I think Incredible Hulk will gross well enough.
Well, I think so, because Incredible Hulk also has Iron Man in one scene, so
it's a big do or die summer in this respect for Marvel Comics, because this is their first time out as an independent entity producing these movies on their own without the shelter of a studio. And so they've got their first two big projects, Iron Man and Incredible Hulk. So
right.
They've really got this stacked up for them this summer. And,
but Iron Man does have the advantage in a couple of different ways. First of all, it comes out first. It's got that coveted, wonderful May 1st spot, which, you know, any movie...
Maid of Honor is the only competition, and that's counter-programming, so...
Oh, my God.
Listen to that.
But secondly,
lost Patrick Dempsey.
I just heard someone talking about this at lunch the other day, a couple of other students I heard talking about movies, and someone brought up the Hulk, and another guy at the table said, oh, Hulk, why are they making another Hulk movie? The first one sucked. And Iron Man doesn't have to deal with that. No one's saying, well, why are they making an Iron Man movie? Everyone's saying, hey, let's go see Iron Man, you know?
And plus, Hulk, like you said, it's in the thick of the summer.
Yeah.
It's got to combat with very similar movies, you know?
Has one thing going for it, though, the Hulk. This one. It seems it's more in line with the TV series we grew up with. And people might respond positively to that. It does seem more like the Bruce Bixby series, so I think people...
I think it might outgross the previous one. But
that wouldn't be hard.
Yeah, I don't see any major success with it. And I hate to say that, but it's just the summers. I mean, something's got to give, man. Especially with Batman being the behemoth of July.
Dude, that's the elephant in the room.
Yeah, and Indiana Jones has got a sweet spot. It's got 2 weeks to itself. And Sex and the City opens up during that second weekend, which I think is great programming for the female crowd.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to be a big success.
It could basically open up any time of the year, though. It's strange that they put it in this. I guess it'll make the most money in summer. That's why they put it there. But there's nowhere you could put that movie that large groups of women wouldn't go out.
Yeah, I know you'll be first in line, Chris.
No. Unfortunately, I tried to watch the show. It's not my thing. It's not a bad show. It's just, you know, there's not much there for me. Actually, I take that back. It's a bad show.
Yeah, don't hold back, man.
Don't. Let your feelings be known.
The other news.
I'm sorry. If that show was about men, it would be quickly written off as misogynistic and.
And it has been. I mean, they try to do a network. They try to do similar shows about men this past season, and they all flunked. They had like two or three of them. They all flunked. The other story is David O. Russell, who is obviously a great visionary. He makes great films. But, again, a very problematic director. As anyone that sees the YouTube clips for behind the scenes of I Heart Huckabees can attest, I mean, this guy, when he goes on a rampage, he cannot contain himself. And all evidence that it's still going on by reports that James Caan has left his latest movie.
If you read the reports, it's not the same thing, though. Everyone's jumping on David O. Russell's ass this time, and if you read it, that's not what happened. The cookie thing, right? It's the cookie. Like,
right.
Choking on a cookie. James Caan wanted to do it silently. David O. Russell wanted him to choke and cough. James Caan said, well, you can't cough while you're choking. It's impossible. David O. Russell said, let's do it both ways. James Caan refused. He would only do it silently. So there are no reports of David O. Russell going crazy here. There's only a report
It's all between the lines. It's all between the lines and the fact that this is the first time in 40 years James Caan has ever walked off a set.
Well,
the publicist said this is just an example of the ongoing creative dispute between he and David O. Russell on the shoot. Nobody's crying, you know, that he was intolerable to work with. I mean, that's not good PR. But we have a history here. And
but that's what you're saying. And I don't think that that's appropriate. I don't think that that's right for people to be jumping on that when, you know, if you look at what's going on here, there's a, you know, when a decision, when something like that comes up on set, shouldn't you do it both ways? Isn't that the way it works typically? That you know, when the director and the actor have a difference of opinion about how something works, typically they do it both ways.
Yeah, that sounded reasonable to me.
Yeah.
And so for him to walk out really kind of indicated that there was a little bit more going on than that. Especially with a career like he's had. And, I mean, he's worked with some of the toughest. I mean, he's worked with Peckinpah.
He's worked with some of the toughest, but he's got a very up and down. James Caan is an advertisement why you shouldn't do cocaine.
God,
Jerry.
He's not exactly. People.
I love James Caan.
All right, let me, Chris, before. I love James Caan, but this guy is someone who, after the 70s, the 80s and 90s, until Way of the Gun, he was in the wilderness. Misery. I'll give you Misery, but you know, maybe Gardens of Stone. But he was in the wilderness. I mean, this guy is. James Caan's always been a cautionary tale. Stay off like cocaine.
Well,
yeah, I mean,
most of the guys from the 70s, you can fall into that line.
Yeah, but he never really. He had a good run there, and then just the 80s were not kind to him.
Right.
So I was surprised. I mean, I would think like Las Vegas, that TV show was very good. That was a very good opportunity for him, and he had some good like The Yards and Way of the Gun in the early part of this decade. But I gotta agree with Chris here. I think it's because of those YouTube videos from I Heart Huckabees, it would be very easy to want to jump on David O. Russell. But maybe
and the reports of George Clooney on Three Kings.
Yeah, but in this situation, there's no report of that.
Yeah.
And another thing, you know, James Caan, he's never walked off a film, but like Jerry's saying, he doesn't have the greatest reputation in the world. So, I mean, just saying that he's never walked off a film, that's like me saying I'm a great driver because I've never driven my car into a lake. You know, there's a little bit more to it than that.
I can't even say that.
Driven your car into a lake?
Well, no, but, like, never mind. That's another show.
Great. All right, guys, our guest is on the line, and if he hasn't been scared off by this discussion, hopefully this is going to be a great conversation because he has a great book out that I can't wait to talk about. The industry has changed significantly, as you all know, as a result of the advent of DVD technology, and an often overlooked byproduct of the DVD phenomenon lies in its ability to educate and inspire a whole new generation of filmmakers. And Richard Pepperman's new book, Film School, How to Watch DVDs and Learn Everything About Filmmaking, celebrates the power of the DVD medium to educate and enlighten, offering detailed analysis and revelations on 50 fantastic films. Mr. Pepperman's previous books include The Eye is Quicker, film editing, making a good film better, and setting up your scenes, the inner workings of great films. He has taught at the New York School, New School University, Pratt Institute, and he currently teaches at the School of Visual Arts, where he has been honored with a Distinguished Artist Teacher Award. It's a great pleasure to welcome Richard Pepperman to our program. Mr. Pepperman, hello.
Hello. How
Thank you so much for joining us. Hi.
And I didn't get scared away.
Thank you. See, Jamie, you overreacted.
I know. I always do.
No.
Tell me a little bit about yourself first and how you found yourself in the film industry, how you worked your way into it.
Well, it was quite a while ago now. It was actually February 1964. I spent about a year calling people, trying to see if somebody would be willing to take a chance on me, and I readily admitted I knew nothing. I had background in the arts and in theater, was involved with an off-off Broadway theater company in New York, and studied acting at various schools in the city, and finally reached somebody at the Film Center building who was one of the supervisors at a lab that no longer exists, Mecca Film Labs.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very kind. His name was Jack Haber. And I called him, and I called him back several times, not trusting when he said, just leave your number. If I hear of anything, I will call you.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point I called him, and he said, I told you to leave your number. I had a couple of things come up. And I said, oh, no. And so he invited me to come down to the Film Center building and introduce me to somebody. And I began by being trained to do track reading for animated shows on CBS and NBC. It just kind of started from there. And then I got pretty quick at getting my week's work done, and so I'd hang out in the editing room to see if I could learn how to use the Moviola and other equipment.
Right.
And moved along from that.
So you worked mostly as an editor in the industry?
I've done.
I think you spoke earlier in your book about how you always taught the approach to filmmaking from an editor's point of view.
Yeah, and most of the courses I've taught, I think other than one, which was an elective class for non-film students, which was an introduction to film, other than that, I've taught the art of editing and various levels of film editing.
Yeah. As an editor, I'm often curious about this because it's such a kind of invisible art. You know, if it draws attention to itself, it tends to be seen as kind of clumsy.
Mm-hmm.
When you watch movies, can you turn that off, that sense of trying to follow the skills of the editor and can you
I
just
do
sit back?
I yeah. do unless something catches my attention, and it can be one of any number of things, and if it catches my attention with enough interest or enough times during the screening, I'll often make a point of trying to get the DVD as soon as that's released. And one of the nice things, of course, now is that DVDs are released much more quickly after a film opens.
It's true.
And then I can spend some time looking to see what it was that caught my attention. And seldom, you know, seldom does it have anything to do with a particularly bad cut. That is, you know, an outgoing moment and an incoming moment. It mm-hmm. has usually more to do with beat construction or structural problems that might catch my attention, and that's not to say that what I might disclose about it is the correct problem or even a solution, but just something that just gets me interested in what someone else's work has been about. You know, it's also, I think, worth mentioning that Paul Hirsch, one of the really great American film editors, once was asked something similar, and he said he thinks that among the real great the great contributions editors make is convincing a director to delete something.
Right.
And so he said it's not so easy to sit and watch and try to guess what was deleted. And I guess it is, again, you know, part of the invisible art notion of film editing.
Well, with some of your previous books and in your experience on film editing and tying it into DVDs, if you were to recommend two or three DVDs that represent a giant leap forward in terms of film editing, which titles would those be?
I suspect anybody who is interested in the advances in that field would likely want to see some of Eisenstein's films. I make use of Alexander Nevsky in film school. Of course, one of his most famous scenes is the Odessa steppe scene in the battleship Potemkin.
Mm-hmm.
People should look out for the DVDs that will display Dee Dee Allen's work, and she worked with Elia Kazan on a little-known film, which I got to see when it came to New York in, I think, 1961 or 2, called America, America.
Hmm.
But, of course, Bonnie and Clyde,
which
changed lots of things. But also, just in talking to some other wonderfully talented film editors that I've gotten to meet, Evan Lottman, who is no longer alive, but a wonderfully kind and thoughtful guy. He and I chatted at one point about what intrigued us about editing, and he mentioned a film that was I found similarly intriguing and an inspiration to get into film, which is Tony Richardson's film, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I guess people should see Breathless by Jean-Luc Godard, The 400 Blows. In film school, what I've done to try to make viewing somewhat easier is I not only have the titles of the films that exist in each chapter, but then I have a cross-reference. So if somebody were to pick a couple of DVDs from Netflix or that they own, they can quickly look to see what chapters address scenes from those films.
Right. But have you seen the art of editing kind of changing over the years? And I'm thinking primarily because so many more movies are being made now to cater to shorter attention spans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's affected editing above all else, I would think.
Yeah, I think so. And I remember, you know, early on when I was still being trained on 35 millimeter film footage, editors would frequently take a piece of film, hold it at arm's length, which was about 3 feet, and say, this is about short a cut as you could make, which is 2 seconds in 35 millimeter. Of course, that's all changed. People's eyes are much quicker than that. And I think for me, the biggest concern I have is that a lot of contemporary films try to have the editing itself, that is the process of joining together these pieces in this particular order, to have that influence the audience's engagement rather than the story. So I find, for example, that so many films resort, and I think resort is a fair term, resort to a parallel editing. That is, you don't stay on any one person or any one place too long, and you kind of cut back and forth, more like cross-cutting than even parallel editing. And it becomes, I guess, an easy solution, and it's almost a one-for-one construction. That is,
yeah.
You know, you're on character A, then you go to B, then you go back to A, then you go back to B.
Sure.
In such a symmetrical fashion that it's, I find it quite tedious, and it avoids trying to locate the real story you're trying to tell.
You know, I find that the cutting in movies now, it's so rapid fire that on the rare occasion when a director chooses to go for a long take,
mm-hmm.
it's jarring, and it's so much more powerful because you're not used to seeing it very often anymore.
Right, right. You know, you might get back to where violence is not so explicit, but only implied, and people will be startled by how effective it is.
Yeah, Yeah, that's true. Do you find that DVDs are becoming more and more, being used more and more in film school as an educational tool?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I hesitated for a very long time bringing in films when VHS format was available, only because somehow I felt that it might be, well, perhaps easier for me as a teacher, but not so effective a way of teaching. Rather, I felt that I should concentrate much more on the work the students were doing. But I've come to realize that that wasn't really the case, and that the difference is that somebody with experience, with knowledge, hopefully with some talent and a broad perspective, can let students in on what they see, because I think so much of the discussions I know I've had with students may not amount to very much unless there's a reference that we can all plug into. So that if you run a scene and then discuss the structure, the beats,
right,
the physical action within the scene, the life of the character, the dialogue, the mood, the atmosphere, the light, etc., it allows for something that led me to construct this new book the way I did, which is the collaborative process of storytelling within film, rather than to break the book down into screenwriting, directing, editing, cinematography, that it focuses on the subjects that deal with the collaboration.
Yeah, and what are some of those subjects again? I know you go through examples of structure.
Right. Well, what I did was I separated the book into three segments. It is story, place, and character. And while particular disciplines are of course influenced and influence the segments, under story I have fragments, which then makes use of five films, which also deals with the history of film. The history of film, of course, is very much reliant upon the history of notions of film editing. But I have fragments, telling, structure, and contrasts, irony, dramatic irony, subplot, transitions, showing, atmosphere, and light is the first chapter in the segment place, which then includes setting, space, setups, and then character, which includes objects, dialogue, reactions, subtext, obstacles, performance, and that's it. Those are the topics.
Yeah, it's very thorough, and it breaks down about 50 DVD titles, and they're all essential titles. By minute and second marker. I mean, you really it's really meticulous how you go through it, and very entertaining to read.
Uh-huh.
I was interested too in the beginning of the book. You talk about an acclaimed cinematographer who was tired of being asked how he achieved his effects.
Right.
Because the real question, if you want to learn, is why, not how.
Right. Yeah, and that was somebody who taught. And I'll tell you who it is. It was Gordon Willis. And so if people want to Google Gordon Willis or IMDb Gordon Willis, he taught a master class at the school where I teach, at the School of Visual Arts, and did, as I mentioned, have included in his class people who signed up who were Academy Award nominees. Willis is extraordinary. And he became discouraged because it seemed to him people were much more interested in learning how he did something, that is to have their work derived from his, rather than why he chose a particular approach. And it was discouraging enough that he decided that there really isn't a master class anymore.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that before, but it makes perfect sense because, just like you said, by asking how, that almost is asking, you know, tell me the ingredients so I can imitate what you did.
Mm-hmm.
When why is the real driving force between the real knowledge behind the thing, because
mm-hmm.
it speaks to the motivation and the artistry of what he does.
Sure, and what is unique within any context. You know, one might list, as I did in this, book, you know, 20-some-odd topics. But, of course, once you throw in a particular context, you hope that the artist can realize that coming to the why decisions matters more than trying to replicate something you've done in the past. Because however common, I think, storytelling in cinema might be, there are literally dozens, if not infinite, possibilities to any particular context at any particular moment with whatever the variables are. And that's, I think, the most exciting part have felt about film editing is, you know, that you want to avoid getting yourself caught up in previous successes or a formula for an approach.
Right.
And pay very close attention to what might very well be the unique moment that you've not addressed before.
Yeah. And speaking of Gordon Willis, I mean, if a cinematographer's job is to tell a story with light and shadows, I think he pushed that to its limits with Godfather 2. I mean, that's
mm-hmm.
extraordinary work right there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he actually jokingly had been referred to as the Prince of Darkness.
Yeah.
There's a great... In fact, they show some moments from the Godfather, and you can see that the lab had a hell of a time pumping light in so that there's a translucent quality to the shadows and lots of grain. And I think... he is interviewed about that moment and laughs about how he really screwed that up. So I think that's a great DVD for anyone to watch.
Oh yeah, it's just incredibly daring work, though. You know,
mm-hmm.
I want you to go through some of these films, a couple of titles, just to give people a sense of the lessons that can be gleaned from your book. You know, they're all essential titles, and they give you a whole new appreciation for some of these moments in the films.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was especially taken by your analysis of some key moments in Lumet's film, The Verdict.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a character transition section that I believe when the lead character visits the hospital room and. What was the lesson to be learned from that particular scene?
Well, one of the interesting things to me about The Verdict is that just about the time Ed Dimitrik's book on film editing was released, David Mamet's book on directing film was released, and David Mamet had written the screenplay for The Verdict. It's an adaptation.
Yeah.
And on the last page of Dimitrik's book, he happily reports this one particular scene. It's a different scene than you're addressing, but I think it's worth mentioning this as well. Dimitrik thought that perhaps film had suddenly broken free from 20 or 30 years of a journey to imitate theater. And was returning to its roots of the European montage approach. And so I thought it interesting. In his last chapter, he talks about Eisenstein and other Russian theorists and then mentions Sidney Lumet's film, The Verdict. And in Mamet's book, he addresses his understanding of film as being nothing more than Eisenstein's notions of telling a story through a cut.
Mm-hmm.
But in The Verdict, there is a scene which I would suspect would have probably voiceover if done today, in which an attorney would reveal to the audience his sudden catharsis.
Right.
And that he realizes that this case matters not only to the family, but is his redemption. But in the film, this drunken ambulance chasing and worse attorney visits a rather rundown hospital where his client is on a respirator in a vegetative state. There's a beautiful use of both the respirator breathing apparatus along with then a Polaroid camera he takes out. And his plan initially is he's going to take some horrifying pictures of this poor woman in a fetal position on a respirator, take it to the archdiocese office because all of this happened at a Catholic hospital in Boston. And then he'll convince them to give him a decent amount of money. He'll take a third. It'll never go to trial. He doesn't have to do any work and just goes on about his life. But in this scene, he takes out the Polaroid camera and the respirator noise and the kind of the Polaroid camera's ejecting the print.
Yeah.
Makes a very similar whooshing kind of sound. And he puts the pictures down. He takes two of them. And then he stares at his camera, of course, both as metaphor that he now sees something that he hadn't seen before. But it's not on a conscious level until you watch the scene some half dozen or more times. And then he just sits on an empty bed next to his client's bed and just stares. And Lamette actually has the two Polaroid pictures come to life and holds more than 30 seconds as the last developing part of that process in Polaroid stills comes about.
Yeah.
And we see his patient on this respirator. And we, of all things, we hear giggling. And it's two nurses on their way either back from lunch or on their way to a break. And one of them looks in and sees Paul Newman, who plays the attorney, Frank Galvin, sitting on the bed and says, sir, you're not to be in here. And he doesn't answer. And she walks towards him and says, I said you're not to be in here. And there's this long 5, 6, 8 second pause. And he never even looks at the nurse. He just says, I'm her attorney.
Yeah.
He doesn't use lawyer in the phrase. And we just get it. And this is a powerful transition within the story and the character.
And it's an example of just a beautiful piece of directing.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's just a terrific filmmaker he is, where it's not on the nose. You know, it's a use of everything in your environment, the props, everything else, and you're right, it probably would include voiceover now so that the audience would feel safe to know that this is exactly what's happening now. But the bravery of that it transmits the idea that his consciousness becomes clear as those Polaroids start to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Just that notion, it's beautiful filmmaking. And you're right, I did not necessarily appreciate the scene in that amount of depth before I read that description of that scene. But somehow I always knew it was there. But
mm-hmm.
That was one of the revelations I found in your book. I'm wondering, before I let you go, what your... in terms of the other extras on DVDs from commentaries and such, are there particular directors or scholars or titles that you're taken with?
Yeah, if I hear, let me just, I can go through quickly. I don't have all of it memorized here, but as I mentioned, and this is in alphabetical order, there's a filmography in the back of the book, and again, then it's in two forms in the contents. I begin with Alexander Nevsky in A, and then Amadeus, Atlantic City, which I would recommend especially to anyone interested in screenwriting. It's one of the great screenplays, I think,
The
last 30, 40 years. A Ballad of a Soldier, which is a little known, at times overly sentimental Russian film from the late 50s. Bonnie and Clyde, Born into Brothels, one of the documentaries I use here. Break a Morant, which is a film directed by Bruce Beresford.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, and I think his work is well worth seeing. I think he's highly underrated, especially after leaving Australia.
Yes,
Breathless,
it is.
The Bridge on the River Kwai, Burnt by the Sun, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Casablanca, Catch-22, Central Station, which is a Brazilian film.
Is that Walter Selle?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's a very good movie.
Yeah. And there's some terrifically presented scenes that I mentioned in the book. Colonel Radel, which is kind of a joint, I believe, Czech, Yugoslavian, Hungarian, German film directed by István Szabó, who is better known, I think, for Mephisto, but it's the same group of actors that he worked with in that. The Day of the Jackal, the original version by Fred Zinnemann, Dr. Strangelove, Dog Day Afternoon by Lumet, 8 1/2, Fellini, The Exorcist, The 400 Blows, The French Connection, The Godfather, High Noon, Hiroshima Mon Amour. I'm reading this from a list, by the way. I hope people don't think I am pounded.
It's an amazing list.
You know, and as you're going through some of these titles, I'm thinking to myself, thank God for Criterion.
I agree with Jamie. Yeah, thank God.
And here, and by the way, there's also a film, it was part of a two-part movie adventure. Jean Dufleurette was the first. The second was Manon of the Spring.
Oh, those are wonderful movies.
Yeah, and Claude Berry, who directed this, I think too frequently produces and doesn't direct, and he's a great director. That's a Jean Dufleurette, I think, especially was successful. Judo from China, Zhang Yimou film. Kolya, The Lady Killers, the original one from Alexander McKendrick.
Oh, that's a funny movie.
Yeah, who also, by the way, has a book that's been compiled by a young man named Paul Cronin, who received McKendrick's notes from McKendrick's wife. McKendrick died quite a while ago, but he had collected over 20 years of teaching notes.
Right.
And Cronin put those notes together in a wonderful book by Alexander McKendrick, on filmmaking,
introduction
to the craft of the director. Yeah, Little Big Man, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, The Miracle Worker, Osama, which is a film well worth seeing.
That's a very interesting film. I think everyone should see that, and I think the title might have scared some people off, but it's very...
That's right.
There's a scene in there that's just worth it alone, but everyone should watch that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where the young girl is working... at the shop where a man prepares milk, heated milk.
Yeah.
And the Taliban come down the street is out. The entire history of understanding cinema is right in that.
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right.
Plenty, Psycho, Rosemary's Baby, Rafifi by Jules Massin, Serpico, The Shop on Main Street, which is an extraordinary work to see by Jan Kadar.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
The Steamroller and the Violin, which is a short I use here. It's an Alexander, Andrei Tarkovsky's thesis film when he was at school in the Soviet Union.
Right, well, you mentioned Plenty. That gets you brownie points to no end. That's an awesome film.
That's the Jessica Lange film from 85.
No, Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep.
I think that's one of her best performances.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned it in the book because it was a little bit of a concern to me. I remember seeing it in the theater and was astonished by the bravery of the cinematographer in the opening scene. They keep it, but they actually have lightened it somewhat, I guess, because of contrast concerns when looking at a DVD on any kind of monitor.
Right.
But I mentioned in the book that it was much, much darker, probably at least a stop to a stop and a half darker.
Mm-hmm.
The Sweet Hereafter, Talk to Her, which is an Almodovar film.
That's a good one,
Tom Jones, the Tony Richardson film. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Touch of Evil, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which I think is a film I've seen more times between the age of 12 and 15 than any other movie. The Verdict, The Virgin Spring by Ingmar Bergman, Viridiana by Buñuel, Witness, and then Z. Just so I have something from A to Z.
Are you kidding? Z is one of Z is one of those films I would tell anyone who's interested in making a political film, that's the one to start with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is the essential Z title right there.
Yeah.
And what are you going to do, put Zoolander in there?
Wait, there is one title you could put there,
right.
Zardoz, but...
Or Zorba the Greek.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's right. If anyone that's interested in purchasing this book, and it is a wonderful book, you'll see the image of the book on the page that you're on now, or our homepage of Blog Talk Radio. Click on that. It'll take you directly to Amazon where you can purchase it. Mr. Peppermint, this has been a delight. Please come on any time in the future. We're just geeking out here. We'd love to talk films with you any time.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.
I'm glad I got to listen in a little bit, and it sounds like just an absolutely terrific program. So I'm going to dial in and listen in.
Well, thank you.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you very much, sir.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, take care now.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, good night.
That is Richard Peppermint, a great book, Film School, How to Watch DVDs and Learn Everything About Filmmaking. And, you know, all three of us, we love the commentaries and we love the extras. I think we go to those before the actual movies when we buy DVDs.
Sometimes we do, absolutely. And this guy just has really great taste.
Yeah, yeah. I know I've asked you this before, but what are your favorite commentary? Who's your favorite filmmaker to hear a commentary from?
It's not George Lucas. No, I say that because when the Phantom Menace DVD came out, I went home I worked at Borders at the time, and I went home and listened to that.
Right.
And I had to just turn it off.
Well, you're expecting a 2.5-hour apology, and he wasn't.
I wanted to get a refund, but you know, I didn't get that. But I like Coppola's commentary.
Yeah.
On the Godfather film.
Very, very passionate, yeah.
And it's always nice to hear a Coppola. So that would be, of all of them, that's my favorite, to be honest with you. I know that's a typical answer, but that's the one I like.
Chris, do you have a take on this, who your favorite is?
Well, in terms of technicians, just hearing someone talk about the craft of film, I'd say that Steven Soderbergh and James Cameron and Ridley Scott are all very good. But in terms of entertainment value, it would have to be either Kevin Smith.
Yeah, that's another one, yeah.
That's like a party. It's like listening to a party. And then the most entertaining, although not intended that way, is Oliver Stone, hands down.
That's my number one. Oliver Stone's my number one. There's the Platoon commentary that he does. And I know the first pressing of Platoon, where he did commentary. You could hear him swigging the Jack Daniels in the because it was a painful experience for me. Whatever, and then his commentary on JFK, and like 3/4 of the way through it, he gets super pissed and he goes off with this tirade, and it's so passionate and so wildly Oliver Stone. He's like, "Damn it, this is our country. What have we done? He's all over the map. He's great. Great.
I can't wait to hear his commentary on the Bush movie then.
That's a big question mark. It's like I'm kind of happy to see him doing that, because I think his place is to stir crap up, you know. At the same time, the merits of the project, I mean, I have a hard time to believe what has been released in terms of the first 10 pages of the script or whatever it is for real.
Right.
I can't believe that it is. I read that too. There's no way that that's for real.
No, I don't think, I agree with Chris. I don't think the movie is going to, I think, you know, if he really wants to do good, I think this movie will not be released this year, maybe next year.
He says he's pushing for it,
but I think it's a curiosity. But I'm very interested to see what he has to say, because I don't think it's going to be what the right wing thinks it's going to be. I don't think that's what it is.
I think he can't help but be a political film.
Oh, it's going to be
In that respect, the right wing isn't going to appreciate it at all.
No, they'll never like it, but I don't think it's going to be as one-sided as everyone thinks it is.
Whereas the right wing embraced World Trade Center because it's completely devoid of politics.
Right.
And the World Trade Center is the Oliver Stone movie for people that don't like Oliver Stone movies.
That's the best way to sum it up.
Yeah, but Bush is...
movies, for that matter.
Bush's curiosity and even his description of his motivation for directing it, I want to examine how a drunken bum became the leader of the free world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's how he's, like, described it. I'm looking forward to it, and at the same time, I'm preparing myself for an utter disaster. Am I alone in that? I mean, it could go either way.
No, you're not alone, but I don't think it's going to be the film. Let me just go out on a limb here, and of course I'll be shot down by, like an hour or so. But I don't think it's going to be the, like, cookie-cutter left-wing film everyone thinks it's going to be.
No,
I think
Nixon wasn't. Yeah,
Nixon is a wild film.
And Nixon is, I think Nixon is a damn near close to masterpiece that people don't talk about often.
Yeah, I love Nixon. It has so much going for it.
But Nixon, you got to remember, the movie was 25 years or so after the actual events. And there is something
right?
to be said for letting right. things die down a little bit. For, like, look at the movies about the Iraq War. Now, it's true, they haven't all been great. But the universal reaction, or at least in America, the reaction is too soon. It's not too soon in that we're too emotionally attached to it right now. It's just too soon, we can't get our heads out of what's going on in the actual Iraq. I think it'd be the same with Bush if that movie
It hasn't played out yet. Yeah,
yeah, I agree with that a lot, Chris. I just think I'm curious to see what the final product will be.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I am too, but God bless him. This is the kind of project that we want from him, though. You know, like any true stone lover.
I'd take this over World Trade Center every day.
Any true stone lover wants him to just let it all out there, you know,
mm-hmm.
risk. We don't see him as risk adverse. You know, he thrives under pressure and risk.
I just hope he is able to make it surprising, because I think I'm in the same boat as a lot of people. We're just kind of, you hear Oliver Stone is going to be making a movie about George Bush, and it's like, oh, God. Like, you know,
yeah. I mean,
like, the most level-handed guy that should be making that shot, you know? Like, I hope he's able to surprise us with something that's just not this two-hour or three-hour just attack on George Bush. And I have no love for George Bush. I just don't think that would make a very surprising or interesting movie.
No, you're right.
It needs to have some kind of depth to it, you know. But what I'm thinking, there's another film out that HBO is coming out with, and Jerry, I talked to you briefly about it the other night.
Recount.
It comes out May 25th. It is as exceptionally pedigreed as any movie out in the theaters. It's directed by Jay Roach. Kevin Spacey is in it, Laura Dern, Tom Wilkinson, John Hurt, Dennis Leary, and it's about the recount, the 2000 Florida recount. And this is one that I'm really anxious to see.
Right, so am I.
You guys have seen anything on it yet?
Just when I see the advertisements on HBO, that's all I know about the film.
Yeah, it's like another wow production from HBO, and very timely.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously we're going to be facing these same questions again.
I think we're going to be facing these same questions again, actually, at the convention.
Yeah.
And I don't want to go into that right now.
Right. But, you know, some filmmakers out there that are really, and I think this is, I think, with Jay Roach's name attached to it, for some reason I'm seeing, like, satire, you know.
I was, when we talked about it last night, that's what I was thinking about, too. It would definitely be satire.
Yeah. All right, guys, it's been a great show. It's been a lot of fun talking DVDs, too. I like that a lot.
Yes.
We will see you again. Wednesday night we have our special Darfur show.
It's a big show.
Yeah, the filmmakers behind a new film called They Turn the Desert into Fire. And basically we're going to do a Darfur for Dummies. You know, we're going to go through A to Z, the conflict over there and the process by which they made this film and what can be done about the situation in Darfur. You know. So that'll be very different for us, but still firmly engraved in the art of filmmaking, you know, seen through these
Absolutely.
Filmmakers' eyes. So we'll see you on Wednesday night. Guys, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll do it again.
All right, great.
Wednesday night.
All right, good night, everyone.
All right, bye-bye now. If you want to make an impact online, GoDaddy.com is the place to be. Domain names starting at $1.99 and complete web packages at unbeatably low prices.
Best of all, if you enter the code MovieGeeks upon checkout, that's MovieGeeks, you'll get an extra 10% off your order. Get a piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.